Welcome to Left MN Radio Hour, sponsored by Left.MN, the Minnesota website that leans left. I'm Aaron Clems with co-host Tony Petrangelo, and on today's big show, we talk about the news of the week and the State of the State address, and we talk to Ken Martin, newly re-elected chair of the Minnesota DFL party. But first, every week, the weekly wrap. Tony scans the matrix for the little disturbances in those green screens, those little falling characters, that mark news items struggling for recognition in the real world. He plugs in, he grabs them and brings them back into the real world, and then he puts them in the weekly wrap. So what did you find in the matrix this week, Tony?
A poll.
Yay!
We got a poll.
We got polls.
Yes.
It's a pollgasm.
It's February in an off year, and we got a poll.
Yeah, I mean, it was very nice of KSTP to commission Survey USA to do a very wide-ranging poll, actually. I think it was, what did you say, 16 questions?
16 questions.
That's a lot of questions.
Yeah, 4 approval and a bunch of issue questions beyond that, 12 issue questions, some about taxes, some about guns, one about marriage.
Yeah.
All sorts of stuff.
Well, the one that really leaped out at me, even though it's probably not that important, is how unpopular the legislature is as a body. And that's even after we've changed partisan control. So it's not – people's disdain for the legislature has less to do – well, it probably had something to do with the party in control before. But it's a – this is a legislative branch of government problem.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, yeah.
Congress ain't popular either.
No. Well, and I think that – I think that's part of it. And, I mean, yeah, we certainly saw this with the previous legislature. And, you know, the new legislature, I guess, hasn't really done anything yet to the point where – they would have made people change their minds.
Sure.
So, you know, all they've done is assumed power for the most part. So, you know, you see that sometimes, though, where someone does assume power, like a singular politician, like a governor or president, and then their approval ratings do go up or whatever. So, yeah, certainly nobody likes the legislature. Nobody likes Congress.
And guess who's popular? Mark Dayton.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And so I think this is one of those things that folks just don't understand about politics, is they think they overvalue the importance of the legislature. Ultimately, it's the executive of the state that really makes things happen. And, you know, even when you've got mixed control, like we did last time, look, I think Governor Dayton pretty definitively won the showdown with the legislature.
Yeah, he got, what, 98% of what he wanted?
Yeah, I think so. And
that's probably not accurate. I was just
I don't,
a boner phrase.
There were some, you know, he didn't like the source of the revenue that he had to get to keep the budget somewhat in balance and not totally slash and burn everything. But, you know, we'll see what happens. And, of course, we're going to see tests between the legislature and the governor. There's already some cracks developing on tax proposals.
Well, that's going to happen. I mean, all this stuff has to get, you know, going through committee. Everybody's going to have problems with all sorts of different things, but, you know.
Yeah, and the media's job is to go out there and find controversy.
Yes.
And they're, you know, that's their job. They're good at it, and they should be doing that, right?
Oh, yeah.
But at the same time, it's really easy to overstate the level of controversy and understate the level of cooperation between the legislature and the governor. What did we learn about Al Franken?
Well, Franken's also popular. This poll gives him 47% approval, 40% disapproval, which most politicians these days, if they're above water, they're doing pretty good. So, you know, he's pretty popular right now. Those numbers are a little softer than what PPP had him at. They had him at like 52-41, if I remember correctly, which is the same. It's interesting because PPP also had Dayton at 52-41. They had Dayton and Franken at the same. Or no, they had Dayton a little bit slightly ahead of Franken, but they're pretty close.
Yeah.
Whereas this one shows a pretty wide disparity between Dayton and Franken. Dayton's got like plus 15 approval, and Franken's got plus 7.
Yeah.
So there's a pretty significant difference in their approval ratings. But, you know, Franken isn't doing bad. He's just doing less good.
Well, and not only that, but, like, Franken's doing well enough that it's really hard for them to find him an opponent.
Well, we'll talk about that later, maybe, but yeah.
Maybe. The emo representative, Eric Paulson.
Yes.
Oh, man, I don't know if I'm going to run or not.
Maybe today. Maybe not tomorrow.
I'm not really motivated. Well, I think maybe I will. No, I changed my mind, man.
Okay. What about issues? Of course, this was dubbed Gun Week. Up at the legislature, there were 3 days of hearings in Representative Paymar's committee on the House side about a number of gun bills. What do Minnesotans think about gun bills?
They like them.
Ah.
Minnesotans overwhelmingly support a expansion of background checks, 75% support. Anyone who's selling a gun required to have a background check.
So 3 in 4 Minnesotans support the idea that whoever buys a gun from whoever.
From whoever. It specifically says in the question, private individuals, 75% think that that's a good idea.
But of course, as we heard at the Capitol this week, registration is the first step to confiscation.
Yes.
The first step to the Gestapo kicking down your door.
But somehow it's okay to have a registry of mental patients.
Yes.
Right? Like, that's okay. That database is okay, but gun owners is not.
Apparently so.
Because your mental health is not something that's as personal as gun ownership.
Yeah, and I think my favorite one, though, there's a really minor bill that's in this list of bills that were proposed by Representative Winkler. He is working with
friend of the show.
Friend of the show. He worked for working with the National Association of Mental Illness, Sue Abderholden, who's the executive director for Minnesota's chapter, and allowed people to put their name voluntarily on a list and surrender their firearms in case of mental health crisis. And I'm watching this hearing, and there's this dude. His name was Bowling, I think, and he said that he was against the bill because, you know, wives can disagree with their husbands about issues about guns. And so I'd have to have some assurance that wives wouldn't be able to, like, you know, say something to the police and have the guns taken away. And I'm like, oh, this is so awesome. I mean, I guess I got to say another thing about this, too. I'm a guy, all right?
Clearly.
Clearly. But if you looked out at that audience with all the gun supporters, it was overwhelmingly 90%+ male. And if you look at the polling data, too, there's a big gender split on these questions, isn't there?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean...
Shocking.
I actually do think this shot. One thing that does interest me is how we're getting bigger and bigger gender divides on a number of questions. If you looked at the polling data from the last election, if it were just women voting, Democrats would have destroyed everything. Right. And if it were just men voting, Republicans would have been just fine.
Well, I guess that bodes well that we're in the party of women.
I guess so. You're listening to Left MN Radio Hour on AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. I'm Aaron Clems with co-host Tony Petrangelo. We do this segment every week called The Weekly Wrap, where we look at mostly election-related news. And we're talking about the Survey USA poll. Tony's got a whole bunch written about that in the Weekly Wrap post up on Left MN. You can go check it out there.
And also, Minnesotans do not want to see their schools turn into militarized zones.
It's just shocking, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, it's very shocking.
Yeah.
But, again, by pretty substantial, well, by majorities, yeah. Maybe not substantial, but certainly over 50%.
But the political prospects for some of these bills are a little bit dim. I mean, I got to say, you look around, and I think if you're not familiar with the Brick City blog, this is Sean Olson's blog. He's located down in the Southwest Metro, writes a lot about politics. He's got a really good post up right now that it's called Legislative Gun Bills, Sound and Fury Signifying Little. And I think he's probably right about most of what he writes there, that this it's unlikely to see sweeping reform. Mostly because, according to a couple of folks like
David Dill,
representative from
Friend
Crane
of
Lake.
The late debate, apparently.
Yeah, he calls in. Dude, this guy calls into right-wing talk radio shows and brags about how he's got 7 to 10 DFLers that are going to vote in a block and kill any gun bill.
And this is a DFL representative.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well,
in name, I guess.
Do we have to start the dino label? I mean, it does fit. Anyway, the thing about this is that this is the path to victory for a lot of regressive policy. You get the Republican Party to back you in lockstep, and you try to pick off a small but defined subset of the Democratic Party. This is what the education quote-unquote reformers or deformers are trying to do. This is what gun advocates are trying to do, right? So,
well, I guess in this case, if David Dill is to be believed, they're doing it successfully.
Well, we'll see. I mean, it's one thing to brag about this stuff. It's another one to realize in case there may very well be consequences for that stand. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of feeling out early in this legislative session where people are going to feel their oats. They're going to try to see what they can get away with and what the leadership will do in response. And I also think what Governor Dayton has to say about it will probably matter a great deal.
Well, and I guess we'll have to also find out what Fairfax, Virginia has to say as far as if Tom Bach is going to take any action.
Yeah, apparently. But we did one thing that wasn't really all that present in the state address was any talk about guns.
Yeah.
You know, and that absence is notable. And we'll talk a little bit more about the state of the state in the second segment here in a little bit. Let's talk about our favorite emo representative for a minute.
Eric Paulson.
Oh, man, I don't know. Should I run or not?
Well, yeah, if this sounds like a repeat, because previously we had talked about Eric Paulson making a comment about not running for the Senate and then retracting that comment, not saying that he is running, mind you, just saying that he isn't not running.
This time it was a comment that was made to the Humphrey Policy Fellows, and Larry Jacobs, the head of the Humphrey Institute, tweeted about it and said that Eric Paulson just said he's not running for Senate in 2014. And within about an hour, Eric Paulson's press secretary replied and said, no, he is focused on his district right now, but he hasn't closed any doors for 2014.
Yeah, it's like, so you're an you're responding to somebody saying you're not running by saying, oh, no, I'm not running, but I'm not running either.
Yeah.
I'm just keeping my options open. Just don't say anything about it. I mean, really, if you're going to do this, just don't say anything about the Senate. Just shut your mouth and do what you're doing. And until you have something to say, don't say anything.
Well, then you wouldn't be in the news at all then. I mean, I think that's part of the issue here. It's all
yeah,
about...
but now he's in the news looking like a complete idiot. He doesn't know what he wants. Which way do I go?
You were going to say something else, weren't you?
Well,
yeah.
You know, I had to check what the seven words I can't say ran through my mind before I.
We are on the people's airwaves,
yes,
so we have to watch what we say. But you know, Eric Paulson's dalliances with the Senate run are interesting, but he's going to have to make up his mind pretty soon with a popular Al Franken, who can clearly raise a lot of money and run a good campaign. He can't wait forever to make this decision. So, the emo Eric Paulson. Oh, man, I don't know. Maybe I'll run. All right, you're listening to the Left MN Radio Hour on AM 950. When we come back, we're going to talk about the state of the state. You're listening to the Left MN Radio Hour on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Sponsored by Left.MN, the Minnesota website that leans left. You can get podcasts of the show and old shows. You can find out more information on the stories we talk about there at Left.MN. I'm Aaron Clems with co-host Tony Petrangelo, and we're going to talk in this segment about the State of the State address. So this Wednesday, Governor Dayton convened a joint session of the legislature in the House chambers and delivered the State of the State address, which he does every year. And is it every year or every 2 years?
Every year?
I think, I know. That's an embarrassing question to ask going into this segment. But yeah, he gave a State of the State address.
We are well prepared, as always.
I know. I'm sorry. If you teach high school civics and you want to write in, let us know. You know, I'm at Aaron Clems on Twitter. You can tell me that I'm wrong. So in this speech, which was about 45 minutes in length, it's kind of a follow-up on his budget. I mean, it's kind of interesting because... like the inaugural address is followed by the State of the Union address, which hasn't happened yet. Now, in this case, the budget kind of ends up being the opening salvo in the governor's agenda, and then the State of the State address kind of becomes the way that he adds on to it. So there are some things that he talked about in the budget that he doesn't really talk about at all in the State of the State, and then vice versa, some things that the State of the State address kind of brings up for the first time. One that I thought was interesting was environment, because when we had... when we had our guest on the other week,
Ellen Anderson,
she mentioned that they were really trying to push Governor Dayton to take a clear stand in the State of the State address about renewable energy, and he did.
And he didn't. He also mentioned her by name.
He did. He name-checked her, although I was a little bit embarrassed because when she came up on the screen, it said, Ellen Anderson, chairwoman of the Public Utilities Commission, which, of course, if you follow Minnesota political news, she is not the chairwoman of the PUC because she was disconfirmed by the Republican Senate last year. She is actually Governor Dayton's senior advisor on energy and the environment.
Well, I know in the MinnPost piece I read about the State of the State, the person who wrote it, I don't remember if it was James Nord or who, but the phrasing they used was that him name-checking her was a dig at Republicans.
I think it probably was. I mean... The choice to highlight a renewable energy also kind of dooms. There's a bill that was introduced that would eliminate Minnesota's renewable portfolio standard, which requires, as we talked about with Ellen Anderson, a certain percentage of Minnesota's energy be developed or be generated by renewable energy. That's dead. I mean, there's no way Governor Dayton's going to sign that. But I thought it was a good thing. And it also was kind of interesting that it paralleled what President Obama did in his inaugural address. Talking about global warming. So maybe actually we will do something about the environment, although as of right now, there aren't a lot of environmental policy bills moving very fast in the legislature.
Well, I wonder why that is.
Yeah, especially in the House. Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder who's chair of the House Environment Committee.
David Dill.
Oh, have we mentioned him before in the show? Oh,
yeah.
We have.
They've considered bills in that Environment Policy Committee, like whether or not visually impaired hunters should be able to hunt using laser scopes.
What the heck does that have to do with the environment?
It is the Natural Resources Committee, so it does involve hunting and stuff. So that is in their purview, of course.
Oh, so it's environment and natural resources.
Yes.
Okay.
But then, and whether you should use three lines to ice fish.
Yes. Well, those sound like very pressing issues.
The most pressing issues.
Absolutely. For the Environment Committee.
Exactly.
Yes. Good job, David Dill.
Keep it up.
We congratulate you.
When you use phrases like, we must reverse this path toward global catastrophe before it's too late, that's pretty strong language, really. And when you name check Will Steger, now that's awesome. Because Will Steger...
Former BFF of our former governor, Tim Pawlenty, who turned his back on Will Steger.
Exactly. So now it's funny to watch Republicans were like, ugh, Will Steger, who does he know? It's like, yeah, he's been to the North Pole. Okay? You go to the North Pole, come back and talk. You can talk all you want about global climate. Right? Until then, SDFU. All right.
Can you say that on the air?
I don't know. I just abbreviated it. It's fine.
Acronyms are okay.
Other ones, things that I thought were interesting, you've got, first of all, an absence of something, which is there's no mention of gun control at all in the speech, which obviously is intentional. But one of the questions, too, is now, where is Governor Dayton on a lot of these gun bills? We don't know. And the state of the state didn't do anything to clarify that. One thing he did mention, though, that was a surprise to some people was that he took a stand on marriage equality. And subsequent to the speech, Pat Kessler and a number of other folks reported that the governor wants a vote on marriage equality by the end of the session, after the budget, but at the end of the session. And while that may not be like news, I think everyone kind of expected that. It was nice to hear the governor finally say that.
It may be that that's related to the absence of the gun discussion, right? I mean, it seems like a lot of the same rural DFLers who are, maybe part of this coalition that isn't going to want to vote for any gun bills are maybe the same people who would also be votes they need for marriage equality.
Right, yeah.
Maybe the deal is we won't bring up guns, you vote for with us on this.
Yeah, and
I mean, I'm not saying there's necessarily a quid pro quo going on, but he may be extending an olive branch by saying, look, I'm not going to force you into a position on this issue by bringing up in the State of the Union, but I am going to force you into a position on this other issue.
Yeah, State of the State, but yeah.
Or the State of, I'm sorry, the State of the State, yeah. But I mean, rather than forcing them, like, both those issues at the same time, you're going to put those legislators in a pretty tough position on both issues simultaneously. Maybe he was just made the decision, well, by bringing this up, I'm putting them in a tough position. I don't want to do it on both issues.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, we should be realistic. Those kinds of quid pro quos happen all the time. This kind of horse trading happens all the time, and it's not all that seemly, but it's also the reality of how you get things done in a legislature. So I think Tony's probably on to something there. One thing that I thought also was interesting was this idea about an unsession.
Which is like unschooling.
Yeah.
It sounds really cool.
Unschooling. Oh, man, I hadn't thought about it. De-schooling was what I was thinking.
I always heard it called unschooling.
Okay. Well, he was talking about the UNCOLA as his way of referring to that, which was – okay, I love you, Governor Dayton, but when you're referring to, like, I don't know, 20-year-old pop commercials for, you know, looking for your public policy initiatives, I'm suspicious. But here's what his proposal was. He said back in 98 when he ran for governor, which he did, and didn't win, he proposed the idea that the second...
Who did win in 98? Was that Jesse Ventura?
Yeah.
Great times.
And by the way, Governor Dayton took a nice dig at Jesse Ventura and Jesse's checks that basically put us into a structural deficit that he's now trying to get us out of. But he mentions this idea of an unsession where in the second year of the session, we're in the first, which is the budget year, the big year, the larger of the two. The second year is primarily devoted to the bonding bill. And his proposal is to make the second session the bonding bill and then getting rid of laws and nothing else. And everything that was really, unless there was a fiscal emergency or something like that, you would do all your policymaking work in the first year of the session. Now, I think this is a way to put pressure on the legislature. I think he's trying to make the legislature take action on things like gay marriage in 2013 instead of saying, well, we can deal with that next year. So the unsession idea was kind of a...
I suspect people in the legislature would probably rather deal with it this session than next session anyways, since it's going to be an election session. You don't want to be... I think that might also be part of it. You don't want to be dealing with controversial stuff in election year. You either get that out of the year in the previous session.
Right. No, I agree with that. I think that people who are thinking about their re-election in 2014 want to have this on the books in 2013. And lastly, he challenged Republicans, if you don't like Plan A or Plan B, I want to hear Plan C. And it's interesting because you're seeing both Republican activists on Twitter and also other folks pushing Republicans to offer an actual alternative budget. Everyone always does it when they're in the minority, but they never, ever actually do it. So we'll see what happens with that. But for right now, we've got Plans A and B and Governor Dayton's tax plan. So we'll talk about this with Ken Martin. Ken Martin is the chair of the DFL party. He'll be with us in the next segment. You won't want to miss that, so come on back. This is the Left MN Radio Hour on AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. Welcome back. You're listening to the Left MN Radio Hour on the Progressive Voice of Minnesota, AM 950. You can listen to podcasts of the show and read more about the stories that we talk about here on left.mn, the Minnesota website that leans left. And we're joined over the phone today by Ken Martin, who was just reelected chair of the Minnesota Democratic Farmer Labor Party. So congratulations, Ken, and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me, Aaron. It's great to be here.
Right. You guys had a tremendously successful 2012 election cycle. You know, recapturing the Minnesota legislature from the Republican Party was a pretty huge accomplishment. So what do you think were the biggest contributors to that victory?
Well, there are a lot of contributors, no doubt. There's an old adage in politics that victory has 1,000 fathers and defeat is an orphan. But in this case, there truly were 1,000 different reasons that we won the elections in 2012. And not only, as you mentioned, did we win back both majorities in the legislative chambers, but we also picked up the 8th Congressional District seat, retook that seat, and, of course, reelected President Obama, Senator Klobuchar. We're now at the apex of political power here in this state for our DFL party. We've never been more powerful as a party, but as I remind people in our party, with this great trust that the voters have put in the DFL, we now have to actually do good things for the people of this state, and I'm hopeful and optimistic that will be the case. But the reality is there was a lot of hard work and energy put into the last election by DFLers throughout the state, and I think ultimately, again, our base turned out. They supported our candidates throughout the state, and because of that, we won.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point that in 2010, we were literally 8,000 votes away from a Republican governor and a Republican legislature. And then in 2012, that pendulum swung all the way back, probably in large measure, not only to policy disagreements about what the Republican Party was doing, but also to mismanagement and a lot of mistakes being made. But it goes to show that, really, if you don't treat power well, you'll lose it.
Well, there's no doubt, and I think the referendum on the last election really was about inaction and gridlock, shutdown, partisanship, overreach on the part of the Republicans. You know, remember in 2010, the Republicans only won the legislative chambers by a very slim margin, 700 votes in the state House and 2,200 votes in the state Senate. So they did not win with a huge mandate in 2010. We knew that going into 2012, if we had an increase in our base turnout, that we had an excellent shot at winning back the legislature. But more than anything, the legislative races were determined by the fact that people were upset with Republicans in control who did nothing to actually improve the lives of Minnesotans and put this state back on track. And the reality is for us now, of course, we don't want to overreach, but the opposite side of overreaching is actually underperforming. And as I remind our elected officials, we can't underperform. We actually have to do things for the people in this state. We have to advance a progressive agenda. If we do that, I'm confident in 2014 that they'll be reelected to the legislature.
So in regard to that question of overreach versus underperformance, Governor Dayton just gave a State of the State address. There were a couple of parts of that address that were focused on by pundits and people who were paying attention to it. And I was wondering what you saw in that speech as being the the things that either surprised you the most or things that you thought were the most indicative of Governor Dayton's direction over the next 18 months?
Well, let me say first and foremost that I thought that it was an excellent speech by the governor. It laid out a very clear vision for Minnesota's future and a clear choice around what needs to happen during this budget debate between now and May. First and foremost, I thought what the governor laid out, he understands that the decisions of the last 10 years have been a failed experiment and that we need to both invest in Minnesota's future and also fix our broken tax system for the middle class. And until we do that, there's no way that Minnesota can succeed. And so I thought he laid out a very clear vision about how we do that. But at the same time, he didn't back away from controversial issues. He recognized the need to move forward on marriage equality in this state. He recognized the need for our state to invest in clean energy and clean energy jobs for the future, making sure that we're protecting our environment while at the same time creating jobs. The governor, I thought, was very clear about his priorities. And, frankly, the Republicans continue to be the party of no. They continue to be the party of the status quo instead of offering up solutions or ideas on how to move this state forward. The only thing they've done is be critics from the sideline. And, you know, what I'd like to see, regardless of your partisan affiliation, you know, I think it's time we get back to a debate about ideas and plans. And, you know, I think it's important for Representative Dowd and Senator Hand to actually put a proposal on the table so we can have a fair debate of these competing philosophies. But without putting their plan on the table, the only plan that exists right now is the governor's. And I do think his proposal is great for the state, and I look forward to it having its debate over the coming months.
Let's talk about the budget in just a minute. Before I go there, I wanted to address one thing you just talked about, which was you mentioned the importance of marriage equality. And, of course, Governor Dayton had a section of his speech talking about how he supported that. Subsequent to the speech, a number of reporters indicated that folks were talking about having a vote on marriage equality later in the session after the budget was passed, but sometime in 2013. And this is oftentimes used as an example of overreach on the Democratic side by Republican critics of Governor Dayton and the DFL legislature. You don't think it's overreach to consider marriage equality this session?
I absolutely don't think it's overreach at all. I think Minnesotans spoke very loudly in the last elections that they want to see equality for people in the LGBT community, and that starts with recognizing for people who are in loving and committed relationships, their right to be married. And so I don't think it's overreach. I think if that was our only focus, was pushing social issues, then maybe so. The Republicans led with their chin, so to speak, pushed divisive constitutional amendments in 2010 during the start of that session. And they didn't focus on the bread and butter issues that would actually help this economy grow and put people back to work. By contrast, if you look at the DFL in this legislative session, they're squarely focused right now on putting forward a budget that would actually, grow the economy, put forward a fair tax system for all Minnesotans with real reform and no games and no gimmicks. And that's exactly what we need. And I think that once we've done that and we get the budget passed and the tax reform piece passed, there'll still be time left in this legislative session to address some of these issues that Minnesotans care about, including marriage equality.
You're listening to the Left MN Radio Hour. This is AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. I'm Aaron Klems with co-host Tony Petrangelo, and we're talking today with Ken Martin, chair of the Minnesota DFL party. As far as the budget goes, I find one of the more fascinating things that, first of all, you don't hear any Republicans talking about Governor Dayton's proposal on income tax, just on sales tax, and particularly on business-to-business taxes. And recent polling data came out indicating that about two-thirds of Minnesotans support Governor Dayton's approach to taxing the wealthy, making sure that they pay their fair share of taxes. Where do you think this tax debate's going to go? Everyone wants the things that we're going to pay for with increased tax revenue, like higher education, early childhood scholarships, and all-day kindergarten. Where do you think we're going to end up with this tax debate?
Well, I'm hopeful that it actually will end up passing, but the reality is that we know that we cannot cut our way to prosperity. just as much as we know that we can't simply, you know, tax our way to greatness. There are some on the left who think a tax is the solution to every problem, and there's others on the right who think we can cut our way to growth. And the governor has presented a very fair and balanced approach and budget that actually doesn't have any gimmicks and any games involved. It's real reform, and I am really hopeful that we'll be able to actually move that piece forward. Now, you mentioned the fact that the business community seems to be fixated on the sales tax expansion, and in particular the business-to-business service piece. You know, one of the reasons is because if you look at the rest of the budget as a whole, there's no doubt that business leaders have been clamoring for many of these investments, as well as other Minnesotans for years, the investments in education, the investments in our infrastructure, our roads, our bridges, the investment in mass transit, et cetera. You go down the list, these are all key pieces of actually moving our state forward. And you don't see a lot of disagreement with the investment side. What you see disagreement with is how we actually pay for that.
Exactly.
And in particular, what the Republicans and the business community are most concerned about is this business-to-business piece. I think they've given up on the fourth-tier income tax because they recognize that it is unfair that the wealthiest Minnesotans, at this point anyways, don't pay their fair share in taxes. And so, you know, I think the governor and the DFL have been very clear on this since the governor was elected in 2010, that he's going to push for a more fair tax system, and that's what he's doing. The Republicans, I think, have conceded that point at this point, and the battle ground seems to be, at least during this legislative session, around the business-to-business services.
Mm-hmm. Let's turn to a couple of elections that are coming up this next week, down in 14A in St. Cloud. We've got Joanne Dorscher facing off against Tam Mathias and Independence Party candidate Todd McKee. And also down in 19A, down near Mankato, we've got Clark Johnson as the DFL endorsee and primary winner against Alan Quist and IP candidate Tim Gieske. What's the party doing in these two races? How are you participating in these two?
Well, we're doing a lot, from everything from doing independent expenditures, mail, radio, TV, phoning, et cetera, to very intensive direct voter contact on the ground, door canvassing, phone canvassing. Over the course of the weekend, we have several rallies planned both in St. Cloud and in St. Peter, and then, of course, all of the GOTV work on Monday and Tuesday to make sure people get to the polls. You know, the one thing we know is that a special election in the middle of the winter is really anyone's game. And while 19A, the seat down in St. Peter, has been a pretty reliable Democratic district over the years, the reality is we can't take anything for granted. And so we need people over the course of the weekend and the days leading up to the election next week to get out and support Clark Johnson down in that 19A race. And then, of course, up in St. Cloud, that would be a pickup for us if we were able to win that seat, and I think we've got an excellent shot. Joanne Dorscher is the DFL-endorsed candidate, former school board member, running a very strong campaign up there right now. As you remember, Steve Gottwalt, who held that seat before, was the chief author of the anti-marriage constitutional amendment in the House. And his district actually voted overwhelmingly against that constitutional amendment, which he put on the ballot. So we actually feel we've got a great shot. Joanne's a wonderful candidate. 2 p.m. on Sunday, Governor Dayton's going to be up in St. Cloud for a rally, and we would encourage all of the listeners listening today, if they have time, to come up to St. Cloud and hear the governor and then get out and hit the doors to make sure we elect Joanne Dorscher on Tuesday.
And I understand that down in St. Peter, I guess Davis Adolphus, Governor Dayton's planning on making a trip down there on Monday.
That's correct. And I don't know the exact time down there, but he will be down there on Monday. We encourage people, if they have time, to make a visit to St. Peter in that district. We can't take that for granted either. We've got to do the work in both of these districts to win, and I feel pretty confident, given what we're seeing on the doors and the phones in the last few days, that we've got a great shot at both of those seats.
The DFL's had a pretty good record in special, or what we call bonus elections around here at Left MN Radio Hour. What do you think that's attributable to?
Well, you know, it's funny. We didn't used to have a great record. In fact, in 1997, I had just moved back to Minnesota, and I was field director down at the DFL, and one of the first races we had won in about 10 years in terms of a special election was that year. And I think part of the reason is we've made great investments in our field infrastructure. And I think both in terms of the van and our voter file, as well as other infrastructure pieces, pieces that we've invested in, as well as our work with our partners and allies. We actually have a much better, I think far superior, ground organization than the Republicans in this state. And so when you have low turnout elections like you do in special election, usually those organizations or campaigns with a better ground game is going to win. And so I think that's part of the reason. It's really just a function of us making those types of investments in our voter file. Yeah.
Welcome back to the Left of N Radio Hour. This is AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. I'm Aaron Clems with co-host Tony Petrangelo. We're talking with Ken Martin, chairman of the DFL party. And we were just talking about 14A and 19A special elections. You said that people can get down there and help out. Is there any way they can get specific information about how to find out where to go?
Yeah, absolutely. You can visit the website of the DFL, www.dfl.org, to get more information about specific activities that we're going to be participating in over the course of the weekend and the days leading up to the election.
Okay. So one thing that I'm curious about, and this is actually become a kind of a national political news story, you're talking about the voter file. And there's been some reportage, one from ProPublica, also made into Salon.com, querying about what's going to happen with the National Voter File Co-op. And you were one of the, I think they queried like 13 different state party chairs asking about what might happen with this data. I was wondering if you would comment about that, particularly whether or not Minnesota would consider selling some of this voter file data to commercial organizations.
Yeah, and let me say first and foremost that we have not and have no plans to sell any of our data in the future. As a board member of the National Voter File Co-op, we have a policy of not selling that data to any for-profit commercial entity. And so the story really was inaccurate when they said that we were considering that. Mm. What we are considering is selling it to 501c3, c4, and c5 organizations that are that share our values and that would use that data for voter education or issue advocacy work. And a perfect example of this is last year the NAACP was doing turnout work in African-American communities around the country, and they did not have a voter file to work with, and so they approached the DNC and state party through our National Voter File Co-op and asked to access the van. And so we sold them access to the van, and they used the van for their turnout efforts in the African-American communities and their issue advocacy and voter education work. And so that's the kind of work that we're talking about doing, again, partnering with like-minded organizations that are doing voter education and issue advocacy work. We would never sell this data commercially. Frankly, it's too valuable to do that. But we do want to share it with groups that share similar values and objectives.
Well, one of the things about, I mean, so you said C3, C4, C5. I mean, for folks who don't know what that means, some of those folks are nonprofit organizations that might do issue advocacy work. Some of them might be political outreach organizations. Some of these are independent, what we call independent expenditure groups.
Right.
This is kind of like this relates to a broader trend in the question about the role that state parties play in elections. And a lot of folks have argued that in the heyday now of Citizens United, state parties are becoming less and less relevant.
Well, yeah, you know, it's an interesting debate, and I certainly think that, you know, the explosion of independent expenditures is not a good thing on both sides, frankly, because it tends to drown out the voice of the candidates and of all those volunteers that are working on the ground to support that. And of course, in terms of grassroots democracy, it's not good because all the activists involved in the party really get trumped out the more and more independent expenditures continue to explode. But let me say that, you know, we do need in this, you know, modern political landscape post Citizens United, we do need very well-funded independent expenditure vehicles to compete with what the right has been doing these last few cycles. But we also need well-funded state parties because state parties are the ones that are doing the work on the ground. What you don't see independent expenditure groups doing by and large is anything in terms of direct voter contact and the personal kind of campaigning where you're canvassing, talking to voters, one-on-one, registering voters. The reality is most of these IE groups are investing in TV and radio and nasty direct mail. And so, you know, I don't think there'll ever be a time or a day when these independent expenditure groups actually replace state parties. But, you know, I do think that we need to tilt the scales in terms of the campaign finance scales back in favor of candidates and also state parties by having some serious disclosure laws passed, as well as, you know, hopefully eventually repealing Citizens United.
You're listening to the Left MN Radio Hour on AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. I'm Aaron Clems with Tony Petrangelo, talking with Ken Martin. Now, I think that's a really good answer. I totally agree with you. And I think you saw in the last election cycle what happens when, on the Republican side, where they have a state party that's mired in debt, unable to really do the work of direct voter contact, data gathering, et cetera, but still a lot of independent expenditure groups that are pouring in money. I guess it's kind of a philosophical question, but is field work, where you go out and make direct voter contact, any less important now than it was before in this social media, highly mediated age?
Well, it's becoming more important, because what you're finding is that people are tuning out TV. They're tuning out these phone calls that they get. The best form of campaigning, what we've seen over the last several cycles, it's sort of coming full circle, is that sort of direct voter contact, the word-of-mouth campaigns, the testimonials from friends and neighbors, the conversations at the grocery stores, you know, the door-to-door conversation with a canvasser. Those ultimately are the best types of conversations to have and the most persuasive. And so for us, we've actually found that it's come full circle. And as technology advances, it's certainly easier to get a message out, but it's not always the most persuasive.
Yeah. And I wanted to congratulate you on one other thing that was news at the most recent DFL party gathering, that the debt that you acquired in 2011, or I should say inherited in 2011, was retired. How did you go about doing that, and what will that free the party to do in the next election cycle in 2014?
Yeah, thank you. It was a great accomplishment, and you know, we inherited about $725,000 in debt. And I think part of it is just having a vision and a plan on how to win, and making sure that you can talk to enough donors and convince them that their money is not just going to go pay off the debt, but actually help us win elections and advance our cause. And you know, it's hard to raise money to just pay off the debt, and the reality is we were able to do that through the prism of winning elections in 2012, and because of that, we not only retired the debt, we didn't accrue any new debt through that process and go into the election year with a pretty nice cushion.
Yeah. We got about a minute left, and I was wondering if you would just sum up by talking a little bit about what you've learned about the party and yourself as a chair over the last 2 years, and what you're going to do different going forward.
Well, it's a great question. You know, I love this party. I started working in this party back in 1997 as I moved back here from Kansas. And the party is a great place filled with a lot of wonderful activists with great life experiences and just a lot of great background. And, you know, when we can focus that energy and marshal it in one direction, which this last year we did, focus it like a laser on winning elections. And when we come together with common purpose, there's nothing that can stop us as a party. And so I've really just gratified what happened the last 2 years. And win or lose, I was really gratified with the work product that we were able to put on the table. And, you know, as we look to the next 2 years, we're focused like a laser on making sure that we get Governor Dayton reelected as well as Senator Franken. And I'm looking forward to that challenge in the coming months.
Well, thanks very much today, Ken. It's been great talking to you, and I look forward to seeing the great things that will come in the next 2 years.
Thank you so much, Aaron.
All right, you've been listening to the Left MN Radio Hour on AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. Next week, we'll have Jason Alvey from the Four Firkins on to talk about beer laws and Sunday liquor sales. So tune in for that. You'll want to hear that every Sunday, 2 to 3 p.m., and podcasts are available at left.mn. Have a great week.